Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we are reading from the April 4th, 2025 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week, we have Attorney General Pam Bondi. She's on the top step of a stepladder. She's wearing a dress outfit, a kind of purplish pantsuit. She's got on safety glasses, and she's wielding a metal saw. She's going to work on the bronze statue of the famous, I think it's called the Lady of Justice. She's already cut off the sword held by the right hand, and she's working on the right arm. The sparks are flying. The headline is Breaking the Law, Bondi and Trump's Attack on the Justice System. We will pick that up on the controversy of the week. A couple of notes. I am fighting a cold today, so please bear with me. Not surprisingly, much of the news these days has to do with the current administration, and we'll pick and choose so maybe we don't go exclusively that way. But the first main story, well, where we'll start is Signalgate fiasco shows officials flouting security. What happened? President Trump this week shrugged off a staggering national security breach in which top administration officials shared secret war plans against Yemen's Houthi militia on a messaging app and accidentally looped in a journalist. Jeffrey Goldberg, editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, received an invitation to a group chat on Signal, an encrypted but otherwise unsecured commercial app for cell phones, from someone calling himself Mike Waltz. Initially skeptical that the user was really Trump's national security advisor, Goldberg silently observed a days-long debate on the chat. Users identified as Vice President J.D. Vance, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, and other top officials discussed how and when to strike the Houthis to ensure the militants could not sabotage Red Sea shipping. Hegseth shared operational plans for military strikes that were specific enough, Goldberg wrote, to allow an enemy to harm American military and intelligence personnel. After those strikes, in fact, occurred at the specified time, Goldberg realized the chatters were the named officials and removed himself. U.S. law and military protocol require talk of military operations to be conducted on government equipment in secure locations. In reactions to the story from officials on the call, ranged from outright denial of the security breach to minimizing its severity. Testifying before Congress, Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard refused to confirm that she was the TG in the chat, while CIA Director John Ratcliffe denied that classified information was discussed. A furious Hegseth accused Goldberg of peddling hoaxes, insisting that nobody was texting war plans. In response, The Atlantic published the full text chain showing that Hegseth had revealed the equipment, the targets, and the timing of the attacks. Waltz then claimed full responsibility for mistakenly including Goldberg in the chat, but also called him the bottom scum of journalists and questioned whether he did it deliberately. Trump said Waltz had learned his lesson, while House Speaker Mike Johnson advised that nobody be punished. But a few Republicans were critical. Representative Don Bacon, Republican from Nebraska, said he had 99.9% confidence that Russia and China had access to the conversation, adding, "This can get our troops killed." Democrats said such a breach would normally bring criminal charges. "If I had done any of this as a Marine, I would have clearly been court-martialed, said Senator Ruben Gallego, Democrat from Arizona. Someone has to resign. What the editorial said. It was a breach of breathtaking proportions, said the Boston Globe. Goldberg couldn't even believe it was real until missiles started exploding in Yemen, and the chatters responded by high-fiving with emojis, like teenagers after a successful prank. Every official on the cell surely knows that the private cell phones likely used for the exchanges can easily be hacked and compromised with spyware. Worse, by using a private app set to delete the exchange within weeks, the officials may have run afoul of laws on preserving official records. The window into officials' private thinking was alarming, said the Wall Street Journal. Vance second-guessed Trump, saying a strike helped European shipping more than American, and adding, "I just hate bailing out Europe." Advisor Stephen Miller, also apparently on the call, mused that there should be economic gain extracted from the Europeans in return. That tells our allies that the U.S. relationship is a protection racket. They may well conclude they can't trust us with their intelligence. What the columnist said. Waltz may be toast, said Dasha Burns in Politico. As furious discussion rages within the White House, one insider told me everyone can agree on one thing. Mike Waltz is a effing idiot. MAGA types have been demanding to know why he had Goldberg's number to begin with, suggesting it was evidence of Waltz's continued neocon sympathies. And defense hawks are in a bind. They're aghast at the leak, but they've long considered Waltz a rare, sympathetic ear in an administration dominated by isolationists. It's Hegseth who committed the most egregious act by sharing operational plans on an unsecured platform, said Mark Antonio Wright in National Review. Everyone in the chat was complicit, but he most directly put soldiers in harm's way. Trump should fire him. Yet, terrifyingly, no one is even pretending anyone involved will face consequences, said Jonathan B. Last in The Bulwark. The intel breach is actually less of a problem than the fact that everyone presumes the written law does not apply to this administration. Why? Because this happens in dictatorships. Anyone remember Hillary Clinton's emails? Said David A. Graham in The Atlantic. The Signalgate crew should. Many of them spent years blasting the 2006 Democratic candidate for her use of a private email server while Secretary of State. Hegseth, Ratcliffe, and Gabbard all suggested that Clinton should face criminal charges, even though her emails weren't remotely as sensitive as Houthi attack plans. For most voters, even the hypocrisy doesn't move them. The sloppiness involving military secrets should. This is what comes of placing political apparatchiks at the top of our security establishment, said David French in the New York Times. Trump has purged the top brass of the military, and the Secretary of Defense he chose has now proved himself shockingly unprofessional. When you replace professional officers with loyalists, you get a politicized military, like Russia's inept force. All of this could be catastrophically dangerous for American lives. In the controversy of the week, rule of law. Are we in a constitutional crisis? The harrowing question of what happens if a president defies a federal court order has hung over the United States since President Trump's second term began, said Ian Millhiser in Vox. And now that long-awaited crisis may be upon us. On March 15th, federal judge James Boasberg issued an injunction halting the deportation of two plane loads of alleged Venezuelan gang members to El Salvador. Told the planes were already in the air, Boasberg verbally ordered the administration to return the deportees to U.S. soil. But the planes kept flying, said Adam Liptak in the New York Times. Attorney General Pam Bondi claimed the government hadn't defied a judicial order, saying the administration followed Boasberg's written order, which didn't mention the planes. That was all too legalistic for Trump, who called for an impeachment of the radical left lunatic Boasberg. Representative Brandon Gill, Republican from Texas, duly filed articles of impeachment. House Speaker Mike Johnson went even further, saying Congress has the power to impeach judges and eliminate an entire district court. Meanwhile, Bondi is citing state secrets to withhold from Boasberg further information about the flights, effectively arguing that the administration is immune from judicial review. The question now is not whether we're in a constitutional crisis, but how much damage it will cause. Boasberg has the facts and the law on his side, said National Review in an editorial. He's well within his power to temporarily block migrants from being deported under the Alien Enemies Act of 1798, which has never before been invoked outside of a congressionally declared war. Still, Trump and Bondi have just cause to complain about how other federal judges have bent the law past its recognizable contours to thwart Trump's agenda. Unjust rulings can be appealed, but when appeals can take years in a system that lets any of more than 600 district court judges issue a nationwide injunction nullifying a presidential order, grave objections are legitimate. Presidents Joe Biden and Barack Obama both expressed frustration with the injunction system, said Sam Baker in Axios. Over Obama's 8 years, district courts issued then-record 12 rulings freezing presidential policies. In the first 2 months of Trump's second term, judges have issued at least 15. We're not in a constitutional crisis, said Michael Tomasky in The New Republic. We're in crises, plural. Yes, Trump's agenda has met with a salvo of injunctions, but when that agenda includes ending birthright citizenship, guaranteed by the Constitution, seizing Congress's power of the purse, violating the separation of powers, and snatching people off the street to be deported without a court hearing, what do you expect? Trump is at war with the rule of law itself, said Tom Nichols in The Atlantic. With congressional Republicans too loyal or too scared to oppose him, judges now stand alone as our last defense against his authoritarian project. This won't end well for Trump, said J. Michael Luttig in The New York Times. He can bluster all he wants, but Republicans lack the votes to remove judges by impeachment, and sooner or later the Supreme Court will have to step in and assert its undisputed constitutional power to say what the law is. Let's hope so, said Mark Joseph Stern in Slate. But if we've reached the point where the fate of America's 250-year experiment in freedom and democracy depends on at least two unpredictable conservative justices ruling against a Republican president, then we are already in a dark place. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for curation. After an unflattering portrait of President Trump was removed from the Colorado State Capitol. The painting was commissioned by Republicans in 2018, but in a lengthy social media post, Trump insisted the distorted likeness was the fault of Colorado's radical left governor, Jared Polis, who is extremely weak on crime. It's a good week for making America healthy again. After Frito-Lay owner PepsiCo blamed a 3% drop in its salty snack sales last quarter on shoppers struggling with inflationary pressures, while Hostess owner J.M. Smucker attributed a 5% snack drop to more cautious consumers. It's a good week for going solo. After the New York Post reported that more couples are undergoing bathroom divorces and having dedicated his and her toilets installed in their homes. With two toilets, said Debbie Wiener, 66, who spent $100,000 on her own personal bathroom, I have toilet nirvana. But it was a bad week for toastiness. After British police raided the home of an elderly couple who had the heat turned up so high that a police helicopter's thermal camera mistook the house for a cannabis farm. We have the heating on all of the time, said Mavis Lovelock, 78. People of our age feel the cold. It was a bad week for coups. After Robert Ehrlich, multimillionaire investor of the Pirate's Booty puffed corn snack, tried to declare himself mayor of Seacliff, New York, despite losing the village's election in a 1,064-62 landslide. Ehrlich insisted the election was rigged, citing personal knowledge that several of his own supporters voted at least three times. Finally, it was a bad week for inspiration. After a public vote in Illinois to choose a new state flag was won by the existing design, the state seal on a white background. Some may call it an SOB, a seal on a bedsheet, said Secretary of State Alexei Glanulius, but thank you to everyone who made their voice heard. And in other news, Trump asks SCOTUS to allow mass firing of federal workers. The Trump administration this week asked the Supreme Court to halt a ruling by a federal judge that ordered the government to rehire more than 16,000 probationary employees fired from six federal agencies. In an emergency appeal, Acting Solicitor General Sarah Harris called the order an extraordinarily overbroad remedy that hijacked the employment relationship between the federal government and its workforce. U.S. District Judge William Alsup, a San Francisco-based appointee of President Bill Clinton, argued in his ruling that while individual federal agencies can downsize their own staffs, the Office of Personnel Management, which coordinated the mass firings, lacks the legal authority to cut employees in other agencies. In a separate case, a federal judge in Maryland has ordered the administration to rehire probationary employees fired from 18 departments. The title of the briefing this week is Saving the Post Office. The U.S. Postal Service is facing mounting losses and growing calls for privatization. Can it survive? What's wrong with the USPS? It has been bleeding red ink for decades. The U.S. Postal Service delivered 112 billion pieces of mail in fiscal year 2024 and collected $79.5 billion in revenue, up nearly 2% from 2023, thanks in part to two stamp price hikes. But despite that revenue rise, the world's largest postal service still had a $9.5 billion annual net loss after losing $6.5 billion on $78.2 billion in revenue in fiscal 2023. Just days before announcing his immediate resignation this week, Postmaster General Louis DeJoy announced plans to reduce costs by eliminating 10,000 jobs through a voluntary retirement program and inviting Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency to help the agency identify further efficiencies. Those reforms came on top of DeJoy's existing 10-year Delivering for America plan, under which mail processing operations are being moved from hundreds of towns and cities to 60 regional megacenters. On-time delivery targets are being lowered, and mail is left each night at many post offices rather than being collected for processing. DeJoy, who was appointed by President Trump in 2020, said this restructuring is needed to fix a broken organization with a broken business model. Others see these reforms as part of a plot to weaken and eventually sell off the independent agency, which Trump has said should go private. Make no mistake, said Mark DeMonstein, president of the America Postal Workers Union, the Postal Service is under attack. Why is the USPS losing money? In part, it's because the rise of electronic communications has led Americans to send less mail. The volume of first-class mail, which includes letters, postcards, and large envelopes, fell 50% from 2008 to 2023, from $92 billion to $46 billion. Meanwhile, marketing mail dropped by 40% over that period, and periodicals by 65%. Package deliveries have soared with a boom in e-commerce, growing more than 300% since 2008. But that extra revenue can't offset the fixed cost that the USPS says now make up 80% of its losses, including pension contributions for the agency's 700,000 retirees and survivors, and for the 533,000 career employees who will retire in the future. Finding savings and new revenue streams that could help balance those costs is tricky for a largely self-funded agency with a mandate to deliver all U.S. addresses, no matter how remote. What fixes have been tried? When he took office, DeJoy warned of uncomfortable rate hikes ahead. Forever stamps have since jumped in price six times, going from 55 cents in 2020 to 73 cents today. As part of his 10-year plan, DeJoy, a former logistics firm chief and Trump mega donor, also sharply cut employee overtime, reduced post office hours in several states, and cut the workforce by about 30,000 employees. His cost-shrinking drive got a boost in 2022 when Congress passed bipartisan legislation that rescinded a 2006 rule mandating the USPS pre-fund its retiree health benefits 75 years in advance, something demanded of no other federal agency. That law should save the agency about $27 billion by 2032. Have DeJoy's reforms worked? USPS ended the first quarter of 2025 with a $144 million profit, a rare gain after more than a decade of annual losses. But insiders and customers complain that DeJoy's cost cuts have resulted in far worse service. Relaxed standards had led to a nearly 40% slowdown in first-class mail, with on-time delivery of 3 to 5 day mail dropping from nearly 81% in 2019 to 73% last year. In Atlanta, a pilot version of DeJoy's processing centralization plan pushed on-time delivery of first-class mail down to as low as 36% in spring 2023. During a House Oversight Committee hearing last December, Representative Rich McCormick, Republican from Georgia, told DeJoy that many business people he knew refused to use the Postal Service because of such problems. As McCormick continued to lambast DeJoy, the Postmaster General covered his ears and said, "You're talking to yourself." Are other reforms in the works? Trump, who recently called the Postal Service just a tremendous loser for this country, has floated privatization or placing the agency under the authority of the Commerce Department. Such dramatic changes would require an act of Congress, and lawmakers from both parties are reluctant to tamper with a government body that's viewed favorably by 72% of Americans. Privatization is a very bad idea, said Senator Josh Hawley, Republican from Missouri. There's a lot of room to make USPS a lot better. But getting rid of it? No. But Musk, whose Doge organization has the Postal Service in its sights, insists that we should privatize anything that can reasonably be privatized. DeJoy's departure could leave the agency vulnerable to a Doge takeover. What would privatization do? Postal Service outside cities would likely become less reliable, or in some cases, non-existent. More than half of all post offices serve rural areas, including places where private competitors such as UPS and FedEx don't find it cost-effective to operate. About 14.5 million rural Americans lack broadband internet access, making them dependent on the Postal Service for paying bills, prescription medications, and other essentials. Everything important to them comes in the mail, said postal worker Kay Foltz, who works out of a small central Ohio post office. It really is a service that if people didn't have, I think our whole country would be a lot different. And a few of the best columns. First two come from the U.S. Medicaid isn't just for the poor. Medicaid is a middle-class benefit, said Ron Lieber. Yes, most of the program's 70 million beneficiaries are on low incomes. But now that Medicaid is potentially on the chopping block as Republicans in Congress look to make up $2 trillion in spending cuts, it's a good time to consider the millions of financially comfortable Americans who rely on or might one day use the program. Ask around your circle and you'll likely find plenty of them. It might pay for nursing home care for an elderly parent whose nest egg has been drained after 20 years of retirement. Easy to do when the average cost of a semi-private room in a nursing home runs to $111,325 a year. Or it might provide health insurance for an adult children who've aged out of their parents' plan at 26, but earn too little to afford private coverage. Or it may pay for home health aids and treatment for a seriously disabled young child. It's easy to think the Medicaid cuts might only affect other people, but millions of us are just one bad break away from needing Medicaid. If there's any chance your family could face enormous bills for long-term care, an adult child, or a disability, this policy debate affects you too. Bipartisan denial on the debt. Washington's so-called debate over deficit spending is a complete joke, said Veronique DeRugge. As the U.S. faces the consequences of runaway pandemic spending and deficits that could add $25 trillion to our existing $36 trillion national debt over the next decade, neither party is serious about tackling the problem. Democrats refuse to acknowledge the crisis even exists, instead pretending the fix for every economic problem is more government spending paid for by rich people. Meanwhile, they label any suggestion on taming Social Security and Medicare as devastating and hence unacceptable, even though those programs will account for half of all non-interest federal spending by 2035. Republicans, for their part, try to convince voters they care about the deficit, but feed the delusion that they can balance the budget through discretionary spending cuts that leave Social Security and Medicare untouched. A party that really did care about fiscal responsibility also wouldn't claim that President Trump's 2017 tax cuts can be extended with no budget cost, or have pushed through the recent continuing resolution that authorized $1.7 trillion in spending, 47% more than President Barack Obama's last budget. With Washington in a state of bipartisan denial, the debt crisis will only get worse. This column comes from the Czech Republic. The Czech Republic is a free country today, partly thanks to Radio Free Europe, said Peter Honzek. The U.S.-funded radio stations offered us an alternative to regime propaganda when we were suffering under totalitarian rule. And in gratitude, our dissident-turned-president, Václav Havel, offered it a home in Prague after communism fell. Now it and its sister organizations like Radio Liberty and Radio Farda broadcast in local languages to Asia and the Middle East, as well as the former Soviet region, bringing hope to some 50 million people over the airwaves and the Internet. These broadcasts provide some of the only truthful reporting some oppressed people can access. Yet Donald Trump has decided to yank funding for all that programming, just to save a mere $142 million a year. Trump doesn't care about spreading democracy. He cares only about what he can directly seize, like Greenland or Canada. Of course, destroying a critical arm of American soft power won't help make America great again. It's a shameful act of unilateral ideological disarmament that surrenders the information battlefield to authoritarians. This is the moment for Europeans who once huddled around the shortwave radios to pledge to take over funding of RFE, and the Czechs should be the first to offer. Consider it as paying off a debt, not to the current White House, but to the idea of freedom. The last word, a feature article. The victory of the giant White House. Characterless monochromatic mansions have taken over America's wealthy suburbs, said Dan Coles in Slate. When one sprang up next door to his own house, he decided to investigate why. For years, the house next door to ours was condemned. The retired federal employee who owned it lived elsewhere and seemed mostly to use the property to store a whole bunch of his junk. I would sometimes see him puttering around the library in our part of Arlington, Virginia. Though I would have preferred a neighbor who was friendly and present, I was grateful that for some unfathomable reason he never sold the place. Because the moment he did, I knew exactly what would happen to that ranch house, built like ours in 1955. Last winter, we started seeing men pulling up in very nice SUVs and walking around the lot's cluttered backyard, taking pictures with their phones. Because this was a change from the house's usual foot traffic, teens daring other teens late at night to sneak inside, we suspected the property had finally gone on the market. In February, arborists arrived to cut down half a dozen trees. Then, one day in March, a guy driving an excavator knocked the house down, leaving a pile of rubble. It was a windy afternoon, and our yard was soon littered with old penthouses and business correspondence from the 1980s. Construction crews spent the spring and summer building a new house, which, like all new houses in our suburban neighborhood, dwarfed our own. Indeed, the house is quite similar to nearly every other new house built in our neighborhood over the past few years, but in a style I think of as the Giant White House. Giant white houses are white, with jet black accents. The shutters, the gutters, the roofs. They are giant Hulk houses, swollen to the very limits of legally allowed property setback and unnaturally tall. They feature a mishmash of architectural features, combining, say, the peaked roof of a farmhouse with a squared-off sections reminiscent of city townhomes. They mix horizontal siding, vertical paneling, and painted brick willy-nilly. Like the giant White House just down the road from us in Washington, D.C., the giant White House may be occupied by a Republican or a Democrat, but whoever they are rich. Once the house next door was finished, it went on the market for $2.5 million. The house has five bedrooms and six baths and is 5,600 square feet. According to the listing, it has top-end appliances and European oak select-grade hardwood and heated floors in the en-suite bath and a wet bar in the basement. As I've visited other cities in recent years, I've noticed that Arlington is far from alone. This style is becoming the dominant mode in well-off neighborhoods everywhere, from Atlanta to Nashville to Austin to Boulder. If you drive through the Arlington of wherever you live, you'll surely see giant white houses sprouting up on every cleared lot. As one went up next door, I wondered, why are the houses so giant? Why are the houses so white? Why are the houses like this now? American houses actually haven't gotten much bigger over the past 25 years or so. The average new single-family home built in America in 2024 was 2,366 square feet, just slightly up from 2,223 square feet in 1999. But of course, the giant White House is not average. Built in an affluent suburb and meant for the wealthy, the GWH is far bigger. Houses over 4,000 square feet, like the one next door to us, make up 14% of the homes now built in the Northeast, up from 5% in 1999. James McMullen owns MRE Homes, a Northern Virginia developer that builds six or seven new homes a year. It's a pet peeve with many people, he told me. Why do builders build large? Why do they keep building McMansions? It's simply economics, he said. Rightly or wrongly, the market rewards square footage. What are those economics? Let's follow the money at the GWH next door. Last year, a real estate agent named John DeHart, who runs a company called Homes from DeHart, approached the owner's children. They lived elsewhere, and they didn't really know what to do, he told me. They were grateful to have someone take the lead. DeHart collected bids from several builders, and the owner accepted an offer of $880,000 from MRE Homes. That's a decent price, if a little lower than typical for the neighborhood. To construct a house like this in Arlington these days, McMullen said, you've got to spend over $1 million. Once realtors take their commissions, county fees get paid, and all the other ancillary costs are factored in, the developer's profit was more modest than I expected. All in, just on a cash basis, these projects are making anywhere from 8% to 15%, he said. If a developer doesn't absolutely maximize the square footage of the house he builds in this market, he might not make any money at all. The giant White House, though, is not only giant in its floor plan. It's giant vertically. It's a trend that comes not from the suburbs, but from the city. In recent decades, the loft, the converted warehouse, with its open spaces and high industrial ceilings, became popular in American cities, said Paul Preissner, an architect and professor at the University of Illinois Chicago. Those kinds of preferences trickled out to homeowners, and now everyone wants cathedral-like ceiling. The result? The house next door towers over ours. Through my dining room windows, I'm staring at the GWH's above-grade basement. Through the windows of the GWH's dining room, our roof serves as a kind of horizon line. From the second floor, you're looking down on the neighborhood through the upper branches of the lot's few remaining trees. The metastatic growth of the upper middle class house has led to a familiar term of art, the McMansion, Is the GWH a McMansion? I'd never really thought of it that way. I'm a frequent reader of McMansion Hell, the critic Kate Wagner's caustic architecture blog, and while GWHs are McMansion size, they don't sport a lot of the fripperies, the cornices, the colonnades, that the 90s monstrosities on Wagner's sites do. When I called Wagner to ask about this, she urged me to think of the McMansion not as a style of house, but as a type of house, encompassing many possible styles. Enormous entertainment suites for movie watching, great rooms for gathering the family, and restaurant-scale kitchens all serve the same purpose, Wagner said. They interiorize amenities that you would once have had in social settings. As the height of the McMansion offers a barrier against the community around you, the McMansion's sprawling layout renders the community unnecessary. Even its windows are not designed for cross breezes. No one expects you'll ever open them. If it doesn't feature turrets, a man's giant white house is still his castle. You'd be forgiven driving through my part of Arlington if you thought you had stumbled into a monochromatic alternate reality. Pleasantville, before the cholera arrives. The houses really are all black and white. The facades are blinding, like the freshly capped teeth of a Hollywood star. The accents are depthless, burnished black. Black railings enclosing white porches. Black drain pipes crawling down white walls. Black trim delineating white window frames. The windows themselves are so reflective, they too read as black in the blank white face of the house. The house numbers, black and sans serif. We've tested different color schemes and whatnot, and it seems like white has been a fan favorite, said John DeHart. We're delivering a property that's going to appeal to the most people. Given that the vast majority of houses in America are built on spec by developers, Wagner told me, home design naturally tends toward a commonly agreed-upon design ideology that is the least offensive possible. Or as Preissner put it, you never would make a house yellow because you'd lose the three buyers who didn't like yellow. Many of the design choices on GWHs, the white color scheme, the vertical board and batten siding, the tin roof, can be traced to the modern farmhouse trend and basically to Chip and Joanna Gaines, whose Fixer Upper TV show popularized the style among wealthy homeowners a decade ago. But the current GWH has moved just slightly beyond a pure modern farmhouse. Its style is more complicated and ever-evolving. The whiteness of the home doesn't only speak to the traditional white-painted rural farmhouse. It speaks to minimalism, a style that has crept from the elite into the vernacular over recent years. That these structures, which are, when you think about it, about as maximalist as houses can be, should cop aspects of minimalist design is aesthetically confusing. But it's not culturally confusing. Minimalism is a signifier of class, Wagner said. In the 2010s, minimalism was CEOs and people who had architect design houses and Apple. It implies sophistication. Yet there is also something about a great white house's design that suggests the agglomeration of house-like details without actually adding up to an identifiable home. You used to be able to identify houses with some kind of language. Tudor, Foursquare, bungalow, whatever, Preissner said. When I showed him a photo of the house next door, he said, this just takes parts of all of it. When I was a kid, Preissner said, we used to have these flip books split into three parts. You could put Boba Fett's head on C-3PO's waist with R2-D2's legs and then flip them around. For a builder doing architecture for residential claims, that's just what happens. In an era when home purchase is likely the most secure, lucrative investment you will ever make, a house really no longer is a house. It is no longer simply the place where you live. It is your future in building form. It is the way you'll pay for college, the way you might afford retirement. I don't think we think of the dream home anymore, Wagner said. We now see houses primarily as a vehicle for investment. The best way to do that is if everything looks the same. In the autumn, a sign appeared on the tiny front lawn of the place next door, advertising an open house. That Sunday morning, I walked over and knocked on the door. Though the Ring doorbell registered my presence, no one answered. The open house hadn't yet begun. I let myself in and slipped blue cotton booties over my shoes. The house's interior, I had to admit, was beautiful. As my footsteps echoed in its cavernous rooms, I felt as though I was starring in an advertisement for the good life. The broker had staged the house with attractive furniture in taupes and grays. From the GWH's third nicest bedroom, I looked down upon my own house, doll size. It's not like our house is so great, I thought, staring down at it. It, too, was a product of the consumer trends of its time. Developers opened up this part of Arlington in the 1950s, building ranches and colonials, working from the same three or four floor plans across a dozen square miles. When we bought it 16 years ago, most of those original homes still stood, dotted here and there with just a few mansion-y new builds. Our house didn't connote individuality any more than a GWH does. If anything, it connoted that we fit in, that we lived in the same kind of house as many of our neighbors. Or at least, that's what it used to mean. These days, our ranch has come to look like a stubborn outlier, expressing in some small way an individualism it never did when we bought it. As the housing crisis grows, as money floods into Arlington, with the missing middle zoning plan meant to ease the county's housing crunch defeated in court, every remaining little house in our part of Arlington is now a giant white house waiting to happen. Someday, relatively soon, we'll sell our little house. I hope some young family will want to buy it and live in it just as it is. More likely, the offers will come from developers. This perfectly good house, where we raised two children and built a life, will be gone in a day. The wind will scatter whatever is that's crammed into our basement. Obsolete phone charging cables, probably, across our neighbors' minuscule yards. And another giant white house will rise. This was adapted from an article first published in Slate. Read one of the obituaries. The boxing champ who reinvented home grills. George Foreman, 1949 to 2025. Fearsome in the ring, George Foreman was so charming outside it, he became America's favorite pitchman. The Olympic gold medalist and two-time world heavyweight boxing champion fought the sports legends, helping define boxing's golden era alongside Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier in the 1970s. After saying he'd seen a holy vision, he quit the sport in 1977 to become a preacher and open a youth center in Houston. But he managed an improbable comeback a decade later. Despite widespread skepticism that he could even get back into shape, he won his second world title in 1994 at age 45, making him the oldest heavyweight champion in history. By then, he was already hawking George Foreman grills, which eventually became a multi-million dollar business. Anything you desire, you can make happen, he said upon clinching his second title. It's like the song, when you wish upon a star, your dreams come true. Well, look at me tonight. Born in Marshall, Texas, Foreman was one of seven children raised by a single mom. He grew up as a petty criminal and bully, something he freely admitted. Dropping out of school at 15, he took up boxing a year later and was quickly seen as a phenom. It took him just 18 months to become the 1968 Olympic heavyweight champion. Once he turned professional, he projected a surly and intimidating persona, calmly obliterating his opponents, said The Guardian. His 1973 win against Frazier produced one of boxing's best-known calls when a shocked Howard Cosell shouted, "Down goes Frazier! Down goes Frazier!" The next year, he lost to Ali and Zaire at the Rumble in the Jungle. After Foreman retired for good, his natural affability helped him transcend boxing and cross over into the media world, said the New York Times. He'd always dabbled in acting, with guest appearances on sitcoms and 2 one-season shows of his own, and he did countless commercials for his grills. These made him a household name, even in homes that never watched a boxing match, said the Houston Chronicle. Married 5 times, he had 12 children, including 5 sons, all named George. Starting in 2022, 3 women accused him of sexual misconduct in the 1970s. He denied the allegations. But he remained a popular public figure, saying the key to his success was his frequent personal appearances. "They want to touch you. They want to know you," he said. "Then they buy you." And we've time enough for one of the Talking Points articles. We'll do law firms caving to White House pressure. "Big law has already begun surrendering," said William Crystal in the Bulwark. President Trump this month targeted 3 major Democratic-leaning law firms for essentially destruction. By executive order, he terminated all federal contracts with the firms and any federal contractors employing them, meaning they'd lose all their clients. This extraordinary diktat seems clearly unconstitutional, and when one firm, Perkins Coie, which had represented Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign, fought it in court, it won a restraining order. But another firm, Paul Weiss, chose capitulation, cravenly agreeing to provide $40 million in pro bono services to Trump causes to get the order lifted. Paul Weiss has been targeted because its lawyers had investigated Trump's business dealings and sued alleged January 6 rioters, and its head, Brad Karp, said it faced an existential crisis. Yet knuckling under to extortion is no way to make it stop. "I do recognize Karp's plight," said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. "He has a fiduciary duty to his firm, and Trump's order could have bankrupted it." Yet Perkins Coie faced the same pressures and chose to fight, which is not just principled, but also pragmatic. Paul Weiss reduced itself to a puppet, existing at the mercy of a president who might renew his order on any pretext. Its meekness only emboldened Trump to strike again, this time targeting Jenner and Block, a firm that employed a lawyer who helped Robert Mueller investigate Trump's Russia ties in 2017. Look, the Democrats really did engage in scandalous lawfare abuses during the past 8 years, said Andrew C. McCarthy in National Review. But Trump's retribution is that he won the presidency and got to fire the government officials who persecuted him. He doesn't get to trample the Constitution to destroy the enemies. "The legal system is the one obstacle between Trump and dictatorship," said Frank Bowman in Slate, "and he's dismantling it piece by piece. He's already undermined judges by defying court orders. Intimidating private law firms is the next step. And we desperately need attorneys to resist." But when Paul Weiss looked to its peers to stand with it against Trump, Karp says rival firms instead tried to poach his lawyers and clients. "The profession is at a fatal juncture," said Lauren Stiller Rickleen in the Boston Globe. "Lawyers can either launch a principled fight to uphold the rule of law, or let the U.S. become a place where democracy is just another banned word." And a few of the short notes. Some 1,400 infants are being infected by HIV daily because of U.S. funding cuts to AIDS organizations, according to the Foundation for AIDS Research. A third of global organizations that provide essential HIV services shuttered days after the Trump administration halted most foreign aid in January. Hundreds of thousands of people have lost access to treatments as a result. Hospital fees now account for one-third of all health care spending in the U.S., totaling $1.5 trillion in 2023. Hospital prices have soared 250% since 2000, growing at twice the overall rate for medical care and triple the rate of inflation. Officials in the IRS and Treasury Department expect a 10% drop in tax receipts by the April 15th deadline compared with last year, costing the government potentially more than $500 billion in revenue. The Trump administration has moved to fire nearly 20,000 IRS employees, and the agency has dropped tax investigations of high-value corporations and individuals. And we will wrap up today's show with a couple of quotes. Ernest Hemingway says, "There are many who do not know they are fascist, but we'll find it out when the time comes." And artist Francis Picabia says, "Our heads are round, so our thoughts can change direction." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, if you have comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.